88.3 KABF Little Rock.
This is Wade's World, and we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
This is Wade Brefke. That means it's Friday. It's 9 o'clock Central Time, 10 o'clock Eastern Time, God knows what on the West Coast. And we're at Wade's World. KABF is our broadcasting studio, 100,000 watts of people power, the voice of the people in Little Rock, Arkansas, and throughout Central Arkansas. We live stream at www.kabf.org. And this show will be up as a podcast on our website, distributed in Dallas, Flagstaff, Seattle, New Orleans, and other cities as soon as we can get it to them. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to my old friend and comrade, Phil Matera, one of perhaps the best corporate researchers of our generation. Phil works at Good Jobs First. Mangled the name on that, Phil, but Good Jobs and Corporate Research Project. He does the Dirt Diggers regular blog and a quarterly column at Social Policy Magazine. Welcome to Wade's World, Phil.
Thanks very much.
Now, did I mess up the Good Jobs name? I've always...
Well, that's okay.
Okay, but the point is, he's working for Good Jobs and it's worth listening to him. Phil, the excuse for me finally getting you on the show, and we may just have to have you on regularly to keep everybody up to date, is supposedly, thanks to the work of the SEC and accounting boards and maybe some other people, there's rumors of some more transparency in the big corporate world. And I know as somebody who's dug through their filings and public records and anything you can get for decades, I'm hoping some of this makes a difference for us doing the work. What's your thinking on all the CEO stuff? Is they're going to have to actually put their salaries out? You think they'll do it?
Well, they actually already put their salaries out. What's new is that companies are going to have to show the ratio of the top person's salary, the chief executive's salary, to the average salary of the workers. So basically what they're going to have to do is give an indication of the disparity between how much people at the top are getting paid and how much people below are being paid. And these are in publicly traded corporations, that is, you know, corporations whose stock trades, you know, on the stock exchanges.
Right.
So it's going to be a useful step. Because it's going to put companies, on the defensive, particularly those companies that are paying their top executives excessive amounts and paying their workers substandard amounts.
Now, one of the things, maybe I misunderstood this, so I'm glad you're going to clarify it, but I thought they were also having to more transparently consolidate all the ways they were being paid and benefits sort of in one place, because sometimes it seems like it's a treasure hunt trying to find what the CEOs and top execs really get in terms of the total package. Did I get that wrong? Is that not going to be clarified this time?
Well, I think there are some improvements that will come in that, but there already is quite a bit. There are these documents called proxy statements that publicly traded companies have to issue. And the reason they're called proxy statements is that their original purpose was to allow shareholders to give their proxy, to kind of hand over their vote to management on issues that would be coming up at the annual meeting of the company. And unfortunately, shareholders, both small and large, traditionally had a tendency to just let management make these decisions. But the documents that were sent out with the proxy forms had to include certain information about the company, and one of those categories of information was executive compensation. So, you know, for a long time now, these forms have given details on how much the, you know, the top dogs are getting paid, and, you know, periodically there are articles in the business press kind of summarizing these amounts and showing who are the most grossly overpaid of them all. And these days, those amounts can, you know, be more than $100 million a year.
Crazy
some
money.
Companies. Yeah. So, but they never had to say anything about what the workers were being paid. And this is whether the company's unionized or not unionized. Now they're going to have to show something about the relationship between the money going to the top and the money going to people below.
So is the best hope that this is sort of a shaming?
Yeah, it's going to serve as shaming, and that's why the so-called business community was so upset about this proposal and fought so hard against it, because their argument is, and, you know, in a sense, their argument is right, which is that the information in these SEC documents is for the benefit of investors, not for workers or the public or the likes of us. So they were saying that, well, why do investors care how much top executives are paid and what the ratio is to the workers? And unfortunately, there's some truth to that, because investors have allowed executive pay to go through the roof. And they've just, you know, been very complacent about that. As long as the company is making money and the stock price is going up, they don't really care whether, you know, these executives are making out like bandits.
Well, in the last, 30 years or so, the ratios have really skewed terribly, haven't they?
Oh, they have, yeah, because there is already some information available and some calculations that have been done, you know, showing that, you know, the ratio, let's say back in the 1960s, you know, was maybe about 50 to 1. So a top chief executive would be making 50 times the average worker, which at that time seemed excessive. But now,
yeah, it still does sound a little excessive, Bill.
Right. But now in many companies, it's more like, you know, hundreds to 1 or even over 1,000 to 1.
Up in the stratosphere, no question.
Yeah, so it's wild what, you know, what these guys are being paid.
Well, to a degree, it forces a discussion, particularly when some of these CEOs are getting these, you know, amazing paychecks, even when they necessarily aren't making that much money or their stock isn't going up. I mean, then you wonder what really is happening. Well, how about maybe what's going to be more important to us? I know this is something that has been something you've looked into, and every time there's a new stadium or basketball palace built or one thing after another, the fight between one state and city after another to lure, I mean, the big Boeing problem between, or Boeing locking problem between South Carolina and Washington, lure plants in with multi-gazillion dollar tax break. New standards are going to all of a sudden make it clear, as I appreciate, that how much taxes are being lost through some of those subsidies. Isn't that a first?
That's right. In fact, just today, an obscure organization called the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, is issuing its final rule on this subject, which, as you say, for the first time will require state and local governments to indicate exactly how much in the way of tax revenue they've given away to the private sector. And this is, it's a kind of amazing that this information has never been widely available before.
Shocking.
And,
exactly.
You know, now, you know, we'll be able to see the total of you know, of what governments are losing. It'll allow better comparisons of kind of the fiscal conditions of different cities and states, And the organization that I work for, Good Jobs First, you know, tracks this these subsidy practices, and it's kind of as crazy a practice as executive pay is. You know, it's another example of kind of egregious giveaways to the people in the private sector. In this case, it's going to the companies rather than to the executives, but it's the same kind of practice of, you know, a few getting enormous amounts. In this case, it's even more outrageous because it's taxpayer money.
That's exactly right.
It's going to these
cities
companies.
Are dying for every dime to, you know, build infrastructure. I mean, I noticed one of the early reports indicated Memphis, which is a long way from being a rich city up the river, not too far from Little Rock or New Orleans or any of these areas in the Middle South. It looks like almost a third of their tax revenue they'd already bartered away any subsidies.
Yeah, it's really an epidemic in Memphis and places like that. Now, what we've done at Good Jobs First is that we've gotten information in many cases on the names of the companies that have received these subsidy awards and the amounts, and have collected this in a tool that we have online called Subsidy Tracker. And we've got hundreds of thousands of individual entries so that you can go on there and, for a given company, you know, you can find out what they've received in subsidies, you know, from state, local, and even federal agencies around the country. There has been improving disclosure, but particularly at the local level, the disclosure has not been complete, and that's why this new GASB standard is important, because it will require all localities to publish this information. Now, unfortunately, GASB is not requiring all localities to indicate the names of the recipients. That was a disappointment. And, you know, we pushed for that, after GASB put out its proposed standard, its proposed rule, which did not require company-specific information. And we and other organizations submitted comments urging them to change that, but unfortunately it appears that they decided not to. So we won't have comprehensive company-specific information, but we will have information on the dollar totals for all jurisdictions. So that'll allow good analyses of how much is being given away. And we'll continue with our Subsidy Tracker project to gather as much information as we can from various sources to kind of fill in those blanks on which companies are the beneficiaries of those awards.
No question. We're talking today to Phil Matera, who's runs the corporate research project of Good Jobs First and has been at this game for decades. Now, Phil, you get the, if GASB puts out this information, that'll force you in terms of building the database on your corporate tracker to just do freedom of information requests in these communities, or what?
Yeah, so basically what we'll have then is are two branches of the database. One which has the information on the company-specific awards so that we can see how much individual companies are getting, and then we'll tally up all the aggregate amounts for the different localities and states. So that you can do either kind of analysis. You can either look at the totals for companies as recipients or the totals that are being given away by specific government entities. And these figures will appear in these documents that are these comprehensive annual financial reports, or CAFRs as they're called, that state and local governments have to publish, and it's often hard to find these things, so we'll track them down and extract the relevant information and put it up on our Subsidy Tracker site.
Well, I know you do read a lot about the controversies, for example, on tax subsidies in the film and movie industry that have been a big competition between California, Louisiana, Georgia, There'll always seem to be another state coming in. But I know following some of the controversy in the Louisiana legislature as they started having such problems balancing their budget earlier this year, one of the things that had to go was some of the outrageous subsidies when it became clear that they were just losing money. I mean, jobs were not being created at the level that they were being subsidized, and it was just one thing after another. We were essentially buying the name Louisiana on a lot of movie credits without getting much for it. Now, some of that's going to obviously put some bullets in our gun for some of these campaigns, isn't it going to be, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, you know, film subsidies are problematic because the jobs that are created are kind of by definition temporary, right? These are film production jobs and that exist, you know, while the film's being produced. And once the film is finished, people move on to another location. Now, you know, to be honest, sometimes these are fairly well-paid union jobs, and that's why some of the film unions like IATSE have tended to support these subsidies. But the problem is that, you know, when you have different states competing against one another, you know, the people who make out like bandits are not the workers. You know, it's the film production companies and the studios
exactly.
that are benefiting from these big giveaways. I mean, we certainly want to see, you know, good, well-paid film jobs and unionized film jobs, but I don't see why taxpayer money has to be going to, you know, to the companies that are providing them.
Well, it's also a difference. I mean, even in talking to some of the union guys on these film sets, I mean, a Teamster driver, I mean, those contracts out of L.A. on that local that have golden pay, you know, sort of a way to pyramid overtime on overtime. But these are workers booming out in many cases from California. The number of local jobs that are created through these subsidies is part of the contention. I mean, we may be keeping the film industry going, but they're going from place to place, and often the number of people developing in a local film industry, which is part of what theoretically these legislators sometimes think they're subsidizing, is much more marginal, particularly on the back end.
Exactly, yeah.
But high road, low road, that's been something we've talked about on jobs a lot. At Good Jobs First and all the work y'all have been doing, where's some good news? Are there some states or cities that are really doing a good job of creating Good Jobs First? We're still looking, huh, Phil?
They're still looking, yes. I mean, the good thing is that state and local governments are getting a little smarter about putting some strings on the subsidies. So, for example, it's becoming more common for programs to have job quality standards. Because, you know, at one time, you know, they would just throw the money at the companies and they can just do whatever they want. Now, in more and more places, companies have to commit to paying a certain amount for, you know, to the workers who are hired at the subsidized facility. Sometimes there are also requirements for, you know, different benefits and so forth. So the concept of job quality is becoming more significant. In fact, some locations are using the prevailing wage principle, you know, that goes along with, you know, construction work, and saying that, well, if there's any taxpayer money, you know, state and local taxpayer money as well as federal money involved in different projects, then the prevailing wage should apply to the construction workers working on the job. And in some cases, they're also pushing for the prevailing wage to apply to the permanent jobs that are created at the facility. Now, this isn't foolproof, because prevailing wages in some parts of the country are not, you know, really high enough to be a living wage, but it's certainly better than people getting paid minimum wage and substandard wages.
No question. Phil, you've written columns for, God, it must be the last 5 or 6 years, every 3 months for Social Policy Magazine. So I actually follow your line of thinking pretty regularly. I know one of the things you looked at pretty closely is how banking has become a criminal enterprise.
banking,
those are my words, not yours. Phil is obviously very restrained as in what he says, but you know, it's hard not to read between the lines. Have banks really gotten away with something since the recession?
Well, yeah. I mean, they basically caused the recession, and they've never really paid the price for what they've done. Particularly the executives at the banks have not paid the price. The companies themselves have been hit with some fairly significant fines, at least compared to the amounts that they used to have to pay for offenses, but it's still something they could easily afford. And that's kind of the dilemma that we have now, which is that these banks are being fined, in some cases, billions of dollars, but it still doesn't seem to make any difference. It hasn't really changed their behavior. You know, the same kinds of shenanigans are going on at the banks in terms of things like mortgage abuses and abuses with the sale of securities. And so it's posed a real question about what will it take to get banks to clean up their act. And banks are not the only ones. There are other kinds of large companies that repeatedly engage in various kinds of misconduct. I mean, we really have a kind of a corporate crime epidemic that's been going on for years. And that's the other area that I follow, along with corporate subsidies, is corporate crime. I publish these things called corporate rap sheets, which are summaries of the various forms of misconduct that large companies have engaged in. And in fact, I started it because there was so much of this going on, it was hard to keep track of which company had been involved in which scandal. And I decided to kind of make these things public. And these are available on the web at the Corporate Research Project website. And now I'm working on a new project that's going to start to come out in the fall called Violation Tracker. It's it's patterned on the Subsidy Tracker database that I spoke about before, and it's going to take data from federal regulatory agencies and put it all together in one place and link the names of the individual violators to their parent companies. So you'll be able to go in and see for, a company like ExxonMobil, whatever, all the various regulatory violations that their different units and divisions have been involved in. It's like a more systematic version of the rap sheets. The rap sheets are kind of in narrative form. This will be in search engine or database form. And the initial version of this will cover health and safety issues. So we'll have EPA and OSHA primarily, and then later we'll add data from on labor violations and financial violations.
Well, that's a great project. So we'll all look forward to seeing once we hear from you that that's all online. This point that you're making, though, is so important about, as big as these fines seem, it looks like for many corporations, and certainly banking is the outstanding one, paying billion-dollar fines is just the cost of doing business for them these days. And it's not encouraging better behavior. There's just an avalanche of, another couple of months will go by, they'll pay another half a billion dollars for, credit card, fault ever. I mean, it's just one thing after another with some of these banks.
And what's amazing is that some of them have even been forced to plead guilty to criminal charges. These are the company pleading guilty to criminal charges. This has happened recently. Several of the big banks had to plead guilty to criminal charges relating to manipulation of foreign currency exchange rates. Yet that didn't make any difference either. I mean, there was one time.
Is the SEC letting them get away with murder on these things? It sounds like they have the ability to actually put some fairly serious hurt on some of these institutions if they are guilty of criminal violations.
Yeah, they should. They should
routinely give them exemption.
Right. They give them waivers from the rules that would normally ban companies from continuing to do business in, you know, in the financial sector if they have a criminal, you know, offense on their record. I mean, it's so ironic
sure
that when individuals
would be in jail for the rest of our lives.
Exactly.
Every day, you know, you read the journal or you read the Times or whatever, and it's just like out of control. And then the SEC is like patty cake. I mean, if that's supposed to be regulation and enforcement, I mean, wow, incredible.
Yeah, it's real. It's a real problem that the regulatory agencies are. I mean, I think they're scared of what the consequences would be if they took serious action against some of the large banks and corporations, and the companies take advantage of that fear and they just go on doing what they're doing, and the corporate crime wave continues.
Is it any better in the European Union or Great Britain? I mean, you definitely supervision of things like Google and tech, they seem to be a lot more militant about trying to get those companies to...
Yeah, well, they're certainly better on antitrust issues and privacy issues in Europe. But, I mean, European companies have been involved in corporate crime as well.
Oh, yeah, over here, this is their play area. We're a colony.
Right.
We're talking to Phil Matera, who's been a corporate researcher for decades and leads the corporate research department within Good Jobs First, has the Dirt Diggers blog, which is worth people checking out. There's regularly more information. Phil, you've been telling us about more tools than most people have available. Let us know how we can connect with your corporate tracker again, your subsidy trackers, and how people can get in touch with you and Good Jobs First and support your work or find out more about it.
Okay, well, there are two websites to check out. For the information on subsidies, including the subsidy tracker, go to goodjobsfirst.org. And for the information on the rap sheets and the Dirt Diggers Digest blog and the other stuff on corporate crime, go to the Corporate Research Project website, which is at corp-research.org. So corp-research.org. So between those two sites, you'll be able to see all these tools that I've been talking about.
And some of the projects you're talking about, particularly this database that you're rolling out next year, it must take, I don't even want to think about the hours of work and eye strain that's involved in that. Who supports all that work, Phil?
Well, not enough people support it.
I know that. Okay. If the ball is any softer coming over the plate, get it on a home run. So how can people support what you're doing, Phil?
Well, they can go to the Good Jobs First website, and there's a button there to click on that will allow you to make a contribution if you're so inclined.
Because you can bet on the fact, having talked to Phil for almost the last half hour, there's not a lot of corporate contributions coming in to Good Jobs First.
Oh, no.
To do what they're doing. Phil, I want to get you back on later this year, early next year, when you have the rest of that database up so we can get into that and talk more about it. This has been Wage World, www.kabf.org, live streaming and broadcast from the studio live at 88.3 KABF, 100,000 watts of people power. Next week, we're going to be talking to an old friend of the station, Matt England, who's now in Flagstaff, Arizona, where this show is also broadcast, about the huge EPA-triggered spill in the Animas River in southwestern Colorado. This has been Wage World. We'll see you again next Friday, 9 Central Time, KABF. Thank you.